All right, thanks. Now I'm really worried that the introduction is going to be better than the talk, so. all right, well, to the organizers, thank you so much for putting this, putting on this workshop. It's a pleasure to be here. Having a great time learning about what other people are doing and learning about your programs. Those are all that information is tremendously helpful for me and how we operate our program at Western State. So I'm going to tell you today about antideuterons and dark matter. And so let's begin. Let me just start with some general statements. Einstein's gravitational field equations relate space-time geometry to the matter and energy that reside in that geometry, right? And due to the historical measurements of the accelerated expansion of the universe, that those measurements really give us information about the actual space-time geometry of our universe on the very large scale. And therefore, by Einstein's general field equations, basically tell us information about the matter and the energy that reside in our universe on the very large scale, really the largest measurable scales. And so from that information, we can construct a little pie chart that represents how energy and matter are sort of split up in our universe. And one of the conclusions you can make from those observations in Einstein's gravitational field equations are that 70% of the energy content of the universe is actually arises from Einstein's cosmological constant. The other 30% arises from matter. Now the catch here, and the important thing for this talk, is that that 30% of matter can't all be accounted for by what we observationally see, right? The luminous matter in the universe only occupies or accounts for the small sort of light blue pie wedge in this pie chart. The rest of it is non-luminous, and we don't see it, and it's generally it's referred to as dark matter, sort of an unknown but nonetheless a component of matter in the universe that exists, and that is currently the details of it are unknown. All right, so evidence for dark matter is not just present on the very large cosmological scales, but also on smaller scales. I mean, not extremely small scales, but certainly some of the, well, maybe smaller scales than the 10 kiloparsec scale. But anyway, galactic scales, galaxies are on, you know, this order of magnitude of the size of a galaxy is about 10 kiloparsecs, okay? And so rotation curves of galaxies and gravitational lensing effects that occur around those galaxies have given evidence that dark matter clusters in concentrations on the order of 10 kiloparsec scales, and so affects galactic dynamics. Dark matter on larger scales also has effects. It's in not just galaxies, but clusters of galaxies, their dynamics are also affected by the presence of overdensities of dark matter. And that galaxy clusters have sizes that are on the order of about 10 megaparsecs or so. And gravitational lensing is also a technique that can reveal the presence of dark matter in those large galaxy clusters. In fact, galaxy clusters, the coma cluster, all the way back in the 1930s, was one of the first, Fritz Zwicky was one of the first astronomers to look out into the cosmos of the coma cluster and notice that its dynamics were anomalous, and he was the first person to coin the term dark matter to explain those that phenomenon. And then, as I mentioned on the previous slide, in the 100 to 10,000 megaparsec scale, the CMB and HISI supernova, which are the techniques that you use to sort of measure the large-scale structure of space-time in our universe, we sort of have that pie chart I showed you on the previous slide that illustrates that even on the largest scales, dark matter plays an important role in the cosmological history of the universe. Yes?
Can you just remind me how big the parsec I'm just never familiar with? How big is our universe in parsecs? Like?
Right. So the observable universe is up to 10,000 megaparsecs. That's kind of the farthest. That's the farthest that has really been seen. So, I think someone can correct me, but I think that's all right. So the point I want to make here is that all of this evidence comes from dark matter's gravitational interactions, all right? And really, so the gravitational interactions of dark matter really tell us that it exists, but it doesn't really tell us anything about it. There's nothing, just because something gravitates doesn't help us understand what it is in detail. Everything gravitates. And so what we really want to really pin down what dark matter is it a scalar, is it a fermion, does it have any sort of other subtle properties? We can only answer that question by looking at dark matter and detecting some type of interaction it might have through non-gravitational physics. Okay? And so that's really what we're after, to lock down not only that dark matter exists, but to sort of understand in more detail what it is. We want to know what are its non-gravitational interactions, and that'll help us understand really what it is. Okay, so one of the first things you should probably consider before moving on here and getting too far afield is to ask the question, well, of the elementary particles that we know exist and the matter that we know exists, the things that we've detected and measured and understand very well, could the dark matter be any of those types of things? That should be your first guess. Okay? And so I think it's useful to go through this list. This little, each box represents an elementary particle here. They're colored in various ways for various different reasons. I kind of like this picture. But basically, this little chart here represents all the known elementary particles, which are microscopically not constituents at all. They're not made of anything more fundamental, as far as we know. And so if you go through this list, you can start to sort of go through this list and ask, could this be the dark matter? Could this be the dark matter? And so let's just do that for a little bit. Well, first of all, even though many of these particles are elementary, not fundamentally microscopically constituent, aren't made of anything more microscopically, they do have very short lifetimes, many of them. They're kind of transient, all right? So the muon, the tau, the charm, the top, the strange, the bottom, the W, the Z, glue balls, if they exist, I can't really remember if they exist or not, but if they do exist, they're not stable, and the Higgs are all unstable, so they decay. So all of these things have very short lifetimes, and they're not stable on cosmological timescales, so those can't be it, okay? So those are ruled out. So, I mean, that's an easy one to do. So the next thing you can do is, well, dark matter has to clump up and cluster, all right? And so one of the things that dark matter can't be is relativistic, all right? It can't be moving fast. So the neutrinos are very light. They're essentially relativistic, and the photon is... is what it is, and so it can't be those. So that's out. Those aren't the dark matter, and so that leaves us with the following options. All right, the up, the down, the electron. Now the up and down quarks combine into the lightest state is the charged proton, and then the electron is charged, and dark matter is dark, so it doesn't interact with light, so it can't be those. All right, basically. So those are out, and so this is our picture. So what is dark matter? It's not that, okay? And so it's really a shame that I have, you know, this is sort of where we're at. We're really forced to propose that dark matter really deserves another box here, okay? Another particle that is different than the things that we already know exist. All right. Okay. Now, aside from the existence of dark matter, right, and the proposal here that it's really a fundamentally new particle, there are other subtle borderline philosophical puzzles associated with this structure. In particular, for those of you, I'm talking about the hierarchy problem and the Higgs mass issue. But I'm just going to say, I don't want to get into the details of that for the purpose of this talk. I just want to say that there are many sort of puzzling issues associated with, independent of dark matter, just associated with this structure that particle physicists like me worry about and causes stress. Now, there are often proposals that attempt to address those other subtle issues, often propose or come along with additional new particles that are extra. They're, in order to solve these conceptual or these types of hierarchy problems associated with the standard model, new particles are often proposed as part of that solution. Okay, and it's actually very generic that those new particles can be stable on cosmological timescales, can not interact with light and can be the dark matter. That is something that's generic in many extensions of the Standard Model. So dark matter, in those types of situations, since dark matter is sort of connected in some way to the Standard Model particles, it's not one of them, but it's by interactions connected to them, then it's natural that any fundamental Lagrangian in a Standard Model extension will couple dark matter particles, which I'm representing as the Greek letter chi here, with Standard Model particles, which I'm just generically writing as QQ bar to be like quark anti-quark. Okay, but it could be positron, electron, or any Standard Model. And this is just representative of many possible operators that couple dark matter to Standard Model. There are many different spin structures and things like that that you could write down. This is just one to represent. All right. Any questions so far? So, all right. Yeah?
Maybe you said this, but why do they have to interact?
It's just generic that they do. So often, let's put it this way. So if I take an example of a Standard Model extension, let me take supersymmetry, all right? So in supersymmetric, what you do in supersymmetric models is supersymmetric models have a way of explaining why the Higgs mass is so small. There's relative to the Planck scale. There's a nice story there. And in order to do that, supersymmetry enlarges the symmetry of the Standard Model, all right? And it basically enlarges the particle multiplets from just the Standard Model to bigger ones. And when field multiplets get bigger, that basically results in predicting new particles, like double the number of particles in the case of supersymmetry. So you wind up with superpartners. And so as a part of the story to make the Lagrangian symmetric under that new kind of higher symmetry, you have to have interactions in the Lagrangian that connect both the superpartners with the normal Standard Model particles. And so as a part of the story of supersymmetry to solve the hierarchy problem, you necessarily have interactions between Standard Model particles and supersymmetric particles.
I guess what I'm asking is,
oh, sorry.
Could there just be something else out there that doesn't interact with?
I would say yes. There could, that story could totally be true. My point here, I guess, is that many situations that do address those types of hierarchy problems do predict new particles with interactions in the Lagrangian. Yeah.
Well, I mean, is the point that if you're trying to extend the Standard Model to explain some problem in the Standard Model, it's got to couple to the Standard Model, but dark matter could be something that doesn't couple to the Standard Model and then we're stuck.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Right? But
sure.
Of course, if you're trying to address the problem in the Standard Model, if you can put it through otherwise, it's got to interact and you're not solving a Standard Model problem.
It's, yeah.
A very simplistic question, yeah. Going back to the percentage breakdown within the universe, just out of curiosity, you know, the visible matter or whatever, does that, you call it atoms, does that also include sort of the dust and things that we can't see, or is that in the dark? I'm just curious, out of the dark matter, is that all?
Most of the matter in the universe is hydrogen. Most of the matter is just hydrogen. Okay. Hydrogen in interstellar medium and hydrogen in the stars. That's the visible matter. And then there is dust and things like that. So but those are smaller amounts than just the hydrogen. Most of it is just hydrogen. So in other words, the universe is kind of, in some sense, I think, very young. Right? It hasn't had time to fuse all the hydrogen. And so it's still mostly hydrogen. So yeah.
So in the dark matter simulations that people do, general question, are they assuming some form of equation of state for the dynamics of the dark matter moving around in these simulations?
Yeah, the best thing I can do, I don't know how to phrase it in terms of rho and p, in terms of the stress energy tensor of Einstein's equations off the top of my head, maybe someone does, but it's particle-like. They use it's dust-like. I don't know if you, well, use
pressureless junction. I mean, it depends on which era you're talking about.
Okay.
It's relatively safe. Yes, I mean, the answer is yes.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, thank you for those questions. Okay, so look, If there are interactions in the Lagrangian that couple dark matter to the standard model, right? Interactions in the Lagrangian like that give rise to Feynman diagrams. And depending on how you pick the direction of time in your Feynman diagram, you get different physical reactions. All right? And so the Feynman diagram that arises from this particular interaction is an interaction between two dark matter particles, all right, and two standard model particles, well, particle-antiparticle in this case. And if I choose my time direction to be from left to right here across the screen, then as I move across from left to right, this process sort of describes a reaction where two dark matter particles come in and kind of approach each other, and then somewhere in the middle, they cease to be any dark matter particles at all, and then they're replaced by a state with a standard model particle-antiparticle pair. So this describes what's called a dark matter annihilation. Dark matter can annihilate. So basically, interactions between dark matter and the standard model imply that there's a physical reaction where dark matter can annihilate. Okay, so that's a physical process that's ubiquitous for dark matter models. All right, so now let's go back and let's just take the galactic scale picture of our galaxy, and we have us, I think it's 8.5 or 8 kiloparsecs out from the center of the galaxy here. This is the galactic disk, and the vision now is that, to explain the rotation curves of our galaxies, we've got this dark matter blob now, and we're sort of sitting in the middle of this thing, right? We're sitting in the middle of this dark matter blob. And now I've added to the story that dark matter can annihilate, right? And so what happens is out in this cloud, basically of dark matter, this dark matter halo, you've got, it's like popcorn or something, I imagine. That's what I see in my head. You just have this like popping out of seemingly nowhere, really coming from the energy contained in the mass of dark matter, are particle-antiparticle pairs, all right, all over this halo. All right. And so they populate the particle content of the halo and the basically just the particle content that is around us. There's a physical contribution to particles and antiparticles from these types of dark matter annihilations.
Regular matter gets created out of dark matter creates
through annihilation.
Through annihilation, it's all annihilation creates regular matter.
Yes.
Which is different from big matter, right?
I don't really know what happened at the Big Bang, I guess is the only thing I could say there. So I'd like to just avoid the question, like if that's okay. So, but. No, well, it's spherical, but with clumps. It's kind of, like I said, it clumps on galactic scales. It clumps on megaparsec scales with galactic clusters. And so it kind of clumps on, in simulations, it's revealed that it kind of clumps on many, many different scales. Like, it's almost scale invariant, the clumping, I think, is what I remember.
Isn't it sort of spherical, like more like pinball shapes? I mean, it's not perfectly spherical.
And then it's not uniform in density. It tends to, if I was going to draw a density profile here, it would tend to go up, all right, peaking towards the middle. And there are different models on how you treat this peakiness, okay, whether you cap it off or whether you have an sort of an exponential function that sort of rounds off in the middle. There are different ways to treat that cuspiness in the middle.
Can you measure the density profile from gravitational lensing as well? I know you get the shape from gravitational lensing. I don't know if you get
it. I would think not, but I don't know. I would think.
There's disagreement between simulations and measurements.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so dark matter sitting there out there, potentially, and it's potentially populating the particle content in our galaxy, all right? And this is really the foundational statement of what drives indirect dark matter detection experiments. Okay, indirect dark matter detection is what people do when you go and you look for these annihilation products of dark matter to see if there is some extra component that's not just explained by conventional astrophysics. All right. Now, you could go out there and you could look for matter. Okay, you could look for normal matter, But there's a lot of it out there. Our universe is full of matter. What our universe is not full of is antimatter. That is very rare in our universe. And so the foundational statement which drives indirect detection is that antimatter is rare in our universe. It's very rare, right? And so that means that conventional astrophysics, while it can make antimatter, doesn't make very much of it. And so if dark matter is out there annihilating to antimatter, then there's a possibility that you would be able to see it, because basically conventional astrophysics would be a low background, maybe some background, but lower background, and way lower certainly than matter. Okay, so the idea is that, so there's conventional astrophysics that can make antimatter. And the way that works is that there are just cosmic rays out there moving at high energies. And a very abundant cosmic ray that is present in our galaxy are protons. There are protons at low energy, lots of them. There are protons at higher energy, some of them. And there are some protons, but fewer of them at higher and higher energy. So as you go out on the energy curve, the amount of the number of protons moving at high speed drops off like a power law. But they're there, okay? And so in the galaxy, okay, in the galactic disk, not only are there cosmic ray protons, some of them moving with high speed, the higher energy you go, the fewer there are, but there are also protons sitting in interstellar hydrogen just sitting there, okay, at rest. So if you like to imagine, this is kind of a target frame collision, where a high energy proton comes in. And when a high energy proton comes in and its energy is high enough, it can collide with the proton sitting at rest and create particle antiparticle pairs if the energy threshold is high enough. All right, now this is the simplest process that can occur. All right, you have to always kind of have a lot of final states. The reason is because baryon number's 2 here, baryon number's got to be 2 here. All right, and so the only way I can get that antimatter in here is with a p-bar pair, but I have to have the 2 other antiprotons here. So what happens here is that this is a astrophysical source of antimatter, in this case, antiprotons. Now, antimatter could also arise from dark matter annihilation. So if dark matter annihilates, you can make particle antiparticle pairs and populate p-bar. And there are many experiments presently and in the past that have gone to measure the antiproton cosmic ray spectrum. Right, measuring the protons out there, the antiprotons out there. And these antiprotons are more or less predicted by background. I'm just going to make one reference to one paper. There are many papers out there. But this is sort of a recent paper that takes into account the most recent antiproton cosmic ray measurement measured by the AMS experiment on the International Space Station. They measure cosmic ray antiprotons all the way out to around 450 GeV. And currently, the amount of cosmic ray antiprotons that are seen are perfectly, are explained well enough by this process, and you don't need this one around to do it, okay? So it's fair to say that there's not any type of resounding evidence for dark matter in the cosmic ray antiproton spectrum, okay? Now, the thing that I am kind of entertained about is this idea of antideuterons, all right? So before I get into antideuteron cosmic rays, I'd like to tell you, just to remind you what the antideuteron is, okay? The deuteron is just a bound state of a proton and a neutron, okay? It's an isotope of hydrogen, right? And there's matter, okay? There's antimatter, so there are antideuterons. And antideuterons are a bound state of an antiproton and an antineutron, okay? They're nuclear physics, they're bound. Now, the interesting thing, so just a regular proton and a regular neutron?
No. Proton and
They would annihilate. There's a large probability that antimatter would annihilate. So if they did bind in this way, it would be extremely short-lived. That would be the way to say it. So these are both antimatter, so they can't annihilate each other in any way. So the binding energy here is kind of famously small. It's 2.2 MeV is the binding energy of this bound state. But the mass of these two things, they're two nucleons, so it's got a 2,000 MeV mass. So if these things are moving around, basically the energy carried by the antideuteron is unless the deuteron is essentially sitting at rest, if it's moving fast at all, it has much more kinetic energy than its binding energy. And so it's like, mechanically, it's like two billiard balls that you've used scotch tape to stick together. right? And if they hit anything, they're going to bust apart. The deuteron, the antideuteron, does the same. If it hits anything and tries to elastically scatter, which is the main mechanism by which fast things in the galaxy kind of slow down, is elastic scattering, then the deuteron will dissociate rather than slow down. So the key point here is that antideuterons can't slow down through any type of elastic scattering. They don't have a mechanism by which they can slow. Okay. Now, let's determine what this means for our dark matter indirect detection. Okay? Let's think about, briefly, the production of antideuterons from conventional astrophysics. Okay? It's the same process that made antiprotons. You've got high-energy protons, okay, pretty high energy, and if it's high enough energy, it can collide with an interstellar sort of proton and hydrogen, and it can, if it has enough energy, it can create both a P bar and an N bar. Okay, this is kind of, it's all, I mean, we're getting ridiculous for this process, but this is what it is. And if the P, and if, following up to that, if the P and N bar are coming out with some there's some probability that you will make an antideuteron, and sometimes it happens. Okay, it's very rare, it's extremely rare, but it can happen. Okay, and so antideuterons, cosmic rays, can be populated by this particular type of process. Now, a couple features here. What's the threshold energy? This is like a modern physics calculation, okay? You take this, you ask, what's the minimum energy required by the proton to create this final state? So you can do it, and it winds up, the threshold energy is 17 times the proton mass, if you work it out, okay? All right, that's the minimum energy you need. So, now, the other thing here is that since, if you think about your reference frame of the Earth, all right, you're sitting here, we're in the same reference frame as this interstellar, relativistic scales, we're sitting in the same reference frame as interstellar hydrogen, okay? So this is a target frame, all right? So the deuteron that's created in the threshold process is moving fast in the Earth's frame of reference. It's moving fast. What's the gamma factor? It's a gamma factor of 3, if you work this out. So for this particular 17 of the proton mass energy, for the energy of this incident particle, the D bar that comes out moves with a gamma factor of 3. Okay, it's fast. Astrophysical antideuterons move fast. Deuterons have a low binding energy. They can't slow down. Conventional astrophysics makes fast antideuterons. Let's compare this to the situation of antideuterons created from dark matter annihilation. Dark matter, it's slow. It's clustered. If it annihilates, we on the Earth sit in the same frame of reference as the dark matter. We're in the center of mass frame of this annihilation. And so when an antideuteron, which can be made by dark matter annihilation, is made, it can be made slow moving. And so one thing that dark matter production of antideuterons can do that conventional astrophysics can't do is make slow-moving antideuterons. All right? All conventional astrophysics makes fast-moving antideuterons. And so dark matter-sourced antideuterons move slowly, and then this is the takeaway statement here, that low-energy antideuteron cosmic rays can be produced by dark matter and have essentially, to zeroth order anyway, or maybe even first order, no conventional astrophysical source. Okay, there's no conventional astrophysics that makes slow antideuterons because they can't slow down through elastic scatters.
There's also a threshold for chi bar, either as being very massive or energetic in order to produce.
Yes. Feasible. Yeah, a typical, in many models that explain the sort of attempt to work with the hierarchy problem, the mass scale of the new particles is of order the Higgs mass or greater. And so we're talking about hundreds of GeV per particle, and so well above this threshold. So, not that those are the only dark matter possibilities, but...
It's not terribly slow, because all of that extra mass turns into kinetic energy to these three particles.
So what happens there is the process is more of like a... You have sort of a... If you have QQ bar, or QQ bar, they sort of get stretched out in this flux tube, and then hadronization occurs. And so it's not...
Yeah, so it's not
so this thing, this string, QCD string kind of pops and eventually hadronizes into antiprotons and antineutrons. And so they're not necessarily all moving because they're just popping out of this QCD string. So
there are slow antiprotons.
There are generically some slow ones, yeah. Yeah, or just they come out of like late fracture of the string or something like that, so that the energy's kind of been depleted before they are created. It's a good question. Yeah. Okay, so back to our galaxy and the dark matter halo now. Argued that dark matter should generically make antideuterons. Okay, so there's these antideuterons that are populating, potentially, if it's there, are potentially populating the cosmic ray antimatter spectrum. So you can go out with experiments, or not me, but experimentalists can be very clever and very amazing and go build basically experiments that you send up on balloons, send up on satellites, send up into the sky in some way or another, even rockets in some cases, like little rockets. They they will measure this. What they actually measure is all characterized as cosmic ray flux. Okay, so cosmic ray flux is the number of cosmic rays of some particular species that you measure per meter squared, per steradian, per second, per GeV. Okay, and those units are a little weird, but what it means is that if flux is one, then if I go up with 1 meter square of detector and I expose it for 1 second to one steradian on the sky, and I look in a GeV bin, I'll get a particle. That's what it means, okay? So you can go up, and that's what they do. They measure this stuff, okay? Now, there are many, this is just sort of a recent list of experiments that go up and measure cosmic rays, and this just kind of, this is more present day, this is more in the past, and this list goes on for a long time, okay? The experiments in yellow here, BESS, AMSO2, and GAPS, have the ability to measure antideuterons. They've got that built in, that they're going to, well, BESS has, and AMSO2 is currently working on, and GAPS will, and eventually in the future, measure or be sensitive to have some sensitivity to antideuteron fluxes. Okay, so now with flux defined, I can tell you sort of how this. I'll show you a couple plots just to illustrate how this works. Okay, so. With a dark matter model with potentially many different, so on this plot, in all the colored lines, not the black one, okay, all these colored lines represent the flux predicted by dark matter models of different masses, okay. As the dark matter mass gets bigger and bigger, the spectrum of flux of antideuterons as a function of their kinetic energy in this case gets less and less. All right. So this particular plot here corresponds to dark matter annihilating to WW, two W bosons, well, W plus W minus. And then this plot here corresponds to a dark matter candidate annihilating to TT bar, top, anti-top. In the black line here, which is the same on each of these plots, this is the background antideuteron coming from conventional cosmic rays. Now, I said that all antideuterons and cosmic rays, conventional astrophysics, are fast. They can't slow down. So that was a zeroth order statement. As the antideuterons, as they come and get trapped in the magnetic field of the Earth and radiate, they can lose some energy. And so there is some leakage of antideuteron cosmic rays to low energy via that effect. I'll just point you to the fact that the scale on the plot is 5 orders of magnitude from bottom to top, okay? So just a little bit of drop is quite a bit of, I mean, this thing is, it looks like it's just a little bit, but it's actually quite a bit of drop in terms of the amount of flux. All right, yeah.
Experimental background.
This is conventional astrophysics.
But is it modeling or data?
There is no data, it is modeling, yeah. Okay. And the colored curves are just the prediction you would get from different dark matter models of different masses, all the way from what is threshold, kinematic threshold, all the way up to 1,000 GeV for the dark matter mass. Now, the whole point here is that, look, for antiproton cosmic rays, for instance, the background and the signal were at least comparable. Here in these plots, you see that the signal is above the background, and that's the important feature of antideuterons. Even though they're very rare, these fluxes are extremely small. They're very small. Antideuteron formation is very rare. But background is expected to be considerably less than signal in many of these cases. All right. Now, the fun part here that I'll sort of... Well, okay, so... all right. Now, I want to mention the three experiments that are... Oh, yeah, sorry.
At the risk of being an uninformed spoil sport, I keep... Every time somebody finds an interesting signal that, to this non-expert, the science news outlets say is a possible dark matter candidate, we are immediately reminded that astrophysical backgrounds are hard to accurately model. There's a reason why astrophysicists still have jobs. So what, I mean, how well known are these backgrounds, really? When you start saying, oh, well, these are the models of the backgrounds, how much reliability should we assume there?
Right. My opinion is that, my opinion is that the backgrounds in these cases, I just want to organize my thought here. There are many cosmic rays of many varieties. There's boron and carbon, any nuclei basically that's out there. There's a cosmic ray, and it's been measured. Its amount, its flux, as energy goes out to some experimental limit. Okay. All of those types of cosmic rays, like boron and carbon and helium and so on, they're all created through this. They're all basically modeled by proton colliding on hydrogen in the interstellar medium. Okay, and basically, for those types of cosmic rays that are created by that process, there's a lot of data for. And so, in my opinion, if I just speak for myself right now, that process, I have confidence that process correctly models production of the cosmic rays that are produced by proton spallation on hydrogen in interstellar medium, I believe, are well modeled. Okay, and that is what that same type of calculation is what produced this background. Now, there's more uncertainty for the deuteron case or the antideuteron case because of some hadronization issues. Okay, so there's a little more hadronization physics that goes into antideuteron formation than goes into something like antiprotons or like positrons, okay, or some other type of cosmic ray species. But the basic proton-proton collision is similar in those cases, right? And so my opinion is that backgrounds are well modeled. What's different is that it's when dark matter produces matter and antimatter, it's a different physical process. It's happening not just in the disk, but outside the galactic disk in the dark matter halo. And then there's a whole phenomenon of propagation. If you know how much injection of antimatter is happening in the dark matter halo, you have to sort of figure out how it equilibriates and gives you some density of antimatter or contributes to the density of antimatter at the Earth in the galactic disk. That process is much more uncertain and not sort of connected to like the helium cosmic rays or the boron cosmic rays, the carbon cosmic rays, where there is a lot of data for. That's the best answer I can kind of come up with.
Okay. So. I think somebody made a comment like this the other day. I mean, if you saw an anomalous signal, right, maybe the background is a little bit uncertain, are there other cross-checks, right? So it gives you some information, maybe it suggests this model of dark matter
maybe then there's something else you could go do to kind of discriminate what was producing the anomalous signal. Do you know of any ideas of other experiments or?
I don't know if this answers the question or not, but this is, I view that, so what you're looking for in any type of dark matter physics is just another handle to get yourself sensitive to some physical effect that dark matter may have. And so with all of the, anytime you, even though a new idea might have a large uncertainty with it, it can still be useful for you for constructing a large sort of, you sort of want to come in at dark matter from many different directions. If a new one is uncertain, you know, that's what it is, and we should still keep it in mind and use it to sort of figure out if it's got large uncertainty, you might not weigh it so heavily, but certainly a new handle is certainly an important thing to have in mind. Yeah. What is what of?
The bedrock.
Yes. Yes, it's a proton, high energy protons colliding with interstellar.
But it can be altered, right? It can be also flux or partial.
There's not really any interstellar hydrogen outside of the galactic disk for cosmic ray protons to collide with. So they are really produced in the galactic disk. So. Okay, so I'll just show you the last. Am I good? We're okay. So getting. That's kind of funny. All right. So this is a little clear. So there's like a clear box here that is associated with this GAPS experiment. Anyway, so there's three different. Well, really, kind of two classes of experiments that are going to go forward in the future and measure or be sensitive to antideuteron cosmic rays of very low fluxes, all right? That, because antideuterons aren't very, if they're out there, they're not very abundant. And so the first one that's currently working is AMS. It has two energy regimes where it can be sensitive to antideuterons. And so it will push down to a few times 10 to the minus 7 in terms of the flux of sensitivity, okay? The AMS is really like, it's like a particle detector, but just in space. So it like uses magnetic fields to bend the particle to measure the whether it's plus or minus and look at the radius to figure out what its mass is and so on. It does lots of normal particle physics kind of detector. GAPS is totally different. GAPS is really aimed at the extreme low energy, low kinetic energy antideuterons, and it works in a way that's pretty cool, I think. It's basically designed to have an antideuteron come in and bind with, form a bound state with the atoms in the detector, I think silicon. And as the antideuteron falls down into energy levels, it emits a very distinct spectrum of gamma rays. And then finally, as if that wasn't enough, the distinct energy of X-rays, it annihilates the nucleus and creates a burst of pions. And so it's like you kind of know you have an antideuteron if you see one. It's kind of cool. It's a neat way to make a really unique.
I like this slide because those dotted lines were very mysterious.
I meant to say ignore the dotted lines in the previous.
The black lines are actually the limits of detection of these.
That's right.
Are they correct for sidewise as well as top to bottom? Because
yeah, some things got shifted around. I added these, so yeah, this is all, there's a little discrepancy right there, I guess, but.
Yeah, and at the top, but it's a full rectangle.
Yeah, the rectangle, sort of, this experiment is designed to come down into this energy, down into this flux range. So if there is a flux of 2.25 times 10 to the minus 7 of antideuterons, that detector will measure it. That's the aim. GAPS is better. That's what's kind of fascinating is this ULDB stands for ultra long duration balloon. It's a balloon. You put it on a balloon and it goes up and they do this well. Okay. If you put it on a satellite, it does ridiculously well. It's kind of amazing.
So you're saying that the GAPS SAT does not have an upper limit, like it's
No, I just had to add it. It still reaches all the way down. It's still, these bottom lines are the sensitivity. So it will do that well. Look at the very bottom of the block.
Okay.
And that's how well it does. So I apologize for the confusion.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so let me just sort of tell you in numbers what I showed in the previous picture, which is usually the picture is the best thing. But I'll just draw your eye, let me just draw your eye to the exponent, okay? So where are we at now? AMS and GAPS have not turned in any data. They have not measured any antidote. GAPS isn't even up there yet, okay? So 2018 is this ULDB, 2018, okay? So this is the current bound from this best experience, 10 to the minus 4 in the flux. That's the current bound. As far as we know, we know nothing about the antideuteron flux below 10 to the minus 4, okay? And what I think is really cool about this is the future sensitivities coming up in these experiments are going to 10 to the minus 7 for AMS, 10 to the minus 8 for ULDB, and then 10 to the minus 9 if you were to put the thing on the satellite. So this is like, it's fresh powder of data. I mean, it's just deep powder. So, I mean, this is 3 or 4 orders of magnitude improvement. It's kind of an amazing progress, all right, in experiment. And these fluxes are sort of in the scale of what you would expect to be populated by dark matter of reasonable masses. I will just briefly end here. Once you know the flux sensitivity of the experiment, and you know the flux prediction by a dark matter model, you can ask, as you increase the dark matter mass, it turns out that the flux gets less and less. And so when the flux becomes less than the sensitivity of the experiment is no longer sensitive to that model. So as dark matter masses get bigger, the flux sensitivity dies away, and eventually the experiment cannot be sensitive to that particular model. So there's sort of a mass reach of, you can characterize basically generally a mass reach for these types of antideuteron cosmic ray detectors. And I'll just bring your eye in this messy chart to just one line here to describe the mass reach of these antideuteron cosmic ray detectors to dark matter models. And depending on the final state annihilation products of the dark matter, 250 GeV, 400 GeV, 250 or 500 GeV, depending on which particular mass, or basically what the annihilation channel is of the dark matter. So there's sort of a mass reach, which is, and that's a pretty high mass reach. All right. So I'll just end. Summary of antideuterons. I would argue that antideuterons are the most sensitive indirect probe of dark matter annihilation. The most sensitive, okay, because the background is lower than the signal for even very large, significantly large dark matter masses. AMS and GAPS are about to make a giant leap forward. I mean, 3 or 4 orders of magnitude leap forward in sensitivity to these cosmic rays, which is exciting. I just dwelled on it just in the previous slide, but you can characterize kind of a mass reach of around 400 or 500 GeV, which is, those are heavy dark matter particles. And so it's kind of impressive that antideuterons could be a good place to look. So I'll stop there. Thank you. So. So I would say the lower limit comes from antiproton data. You wouldn't want to have seen something in antiprotons,
okay,
right? And I would put it there. So the lower the mass, the larger the rate. Mm-hmm. The rate just keeps getting bigger. And I would say antiprotons bound that.
And I guess the second question is to draw your...
And I would say that's a 50 GeV. That would be my,
gotcha. Okay,
my scale for that rate.
Scale, so
thermal WIMP.
Okay.
So.
And did you check, so those are still okay with direct detection bounds?
The kinematics of, so in general, you could have an operator, so there are many types of, that's really model dependent.
Right.
So there are plenty of models where there are interactions that lead to annihilation, but don't lead to detection in the direct detection experiments. Mm-hmm. In general, if you have one, you have the other. But there are some situations I could imagine they might be contrived where you could have the annihilation. So the answer is we didn't consider direct detection bounds because we wanted to be as just model independent. So if dark matter annihilates. Because the annihilation doesn't necessarily, the kinematics of annihilation aren't always the same as the kinematics of scattering. And so one could be, scattering could be small and annihilation could be larger. And so we left that as, yeah.
So I guess, sort of along the lines of the proton particle physics perspective, how sensitive are these measurements to what the dark matter is? You just left it as a generic particle, but is there a way that you could say it is more likely the LSP, for example, than it is something other? Like, can you tell what kind of particle dark matter is from the way the fluxes work themselves out?
The answer is no. You would. This is an extra handle. Okay. So example is, one thing you can look at is, let's pretend you had a model with some mass of the dark matter that was, say, 500 GeV, or maybe that's this blue line or something. All right, and your model annihilates W. Well, it wouldn't produce antideuterons detectable here because the flux is too low. But over here, it would if it was annihilating to TT bar. And so this is not any type of smoking gun of a particular dark matter candidate. It's just another handle. And in this game where you've got, it's so difficult to access this particle, any extra handle is something that should be utilized. That's the sort of spirit behind this kind of thing. Yeah.
So did you say the gaps, the balloon experiment is going to go up in a couple of years, and the satellite, it's not certain whether, what?
I think my understanding is the satellite is just an idea.
Uh-huh.
And
but there are plans for the balloon.
The balloon, they've done a prototype balloon, I think, that was launched from Japan a couple years ago, or maybe a year ago. And it had less sensitivity. But the real plan is to go to Antarctica. I think it's still to go to Antarctica and do the ultra long duration balloon there. So it goes up and kind of goes around in currents and falls out somewhere. So, yeah.
This, I'm guessing, is a naive question, but since this is sort of a generic type scenario, if one were to say, well, what would you do at the LHC to try to produce? Because it looks like the energies are not crazy, then is just the rate just going to be so tiny that you would never see it? Or
you mean at the FC?
Yeah.
To make, if, like, let's assume, so a comment, the super, to go back to an example of like a supersymmetric particle that's weakly interacting, I think it's very challenging to get production of electroweak particles above 500 GeV. Okay. So at the LHC, I mean, you're kind of in that, you're getting in there. There's definitely some overlap. So.
But this wouldn't be something where if you see a signal, you can immediately say, oh, change your cuts or whatever to look for this type of process, or?
Yeah, this doesn't really give you much information about the detail, the interactions, and how to change cuts on a. This is like, yeah, you get some number of events. You just sort of see some number of events, like a few events or something of antideuterons, and then you're like, what do I do with this? Well, it's information, and you can use it, but you can't really back out any detailed sort of. I think the LHC would, if you change things about how the LHC operates, I don't know if from this data, you could really improve things that much. So, yeah, if the LHC sees something, and the LHC being underground and quiet and having all the sophisticated detector technology, you can try, I bet you can if you think about it, you back out more information there, and then you can put that into some model to think about what it would imply. Because, one last question.
So if the dark matter is coupled to the standard model, why would we expect there to be anti-dark matter? Wouldn't some baryogenesis mechanism also get rid of all of the anti-dark matter?
So the dark matter could be, usually the matter antimatter asymmetry is introduced to explain why there's no antimatter now. And so I don't think we really need anything extra to explain why there is no anti-dark matter. So there could be dark matter and anti-dark matter that froze out and is just sometimes finding each other. Or it could be the case like a supersymmetric neutralino where it is its own antiparticle. It's kind of more like the photon in that case. And it can annihilate itself.
But I mean, a really popular idea now is asymmetric dark matter, which is exactly, it's connecting baryon asymmetry, regular matter to an asymmetry for the dark matter, in which case it's true, you would have predominantly one species of dark matter in this scenario would change.
What you're saying is that this would, if you didn't see an anti-deuteron excess, it wouldn't rule out dark matter particles in that threshold if they were matter antimatter asymmetric.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you very much.
I'll 5 minutes for coffee.